After Tillman left Dodge City, he met up with Chris Madsen and Henry Heck Thomas, and they all hired on to bring law to the town of Perry, where they became known as the Three Guardsmen. One of their first duties had been to track down the members of the Doolin Gang, headed by Bill Doolin. One night, on patrol with Heck Thomas, Tillman noticed a crude dugout cabin several hundred yards off the trail they were riding.
Heck, there's a place I never seen before. You hang here a while, I'll go check it out.
Tillman pulled the head of his bay around and walked it toward the light underbrush to the doorway of the dugout.
Yep.
Tillman knocked, then pushed the door open and stepped inside, taking off his hat and flinging water off it to the floor. When he looked up, he noticed in the dim light of a lantern hung from a nail on the wall that both sides of the interior were lined with bunks covered with hanging blankets. At the end of the room, a large riverstone fireplace was blazing, sending out welcome waves of heat into the room. In the center of the open space between the two bunks, a man sat with a Winchester rifle across his lap.
Howdy. I'm looking for B. Dunn's place. How far is it from here?
That's for you to find out.
Well, I was just passing by with my fighting dog and thought maybe I could get B to match a fight. He told me a while back he thought his dog could beat mine.
Tillman, every lawman instinct in him crying out danger, noticed the man's eyes flicking to the sides to look at the bunks on either side of the room.
I done told you to find it on your own.
All right, I'll do that. This fire sure feels good.
Tillman rubbed his hands and stamped his feet in front of the blaze, using his movements to cover his looking at the bunks. He noticed the tips of several rifle barrels sticking out from behind the blankets, and they were all aimed at him.
I guess I'll be gone. Which way does a fella go to get out of here?
Same damn way he came in.
Without betraying the terror he felt, Tillman calmly backed toward the door, jamming his hat back down on his head.
Well, adios, stranger. I'll just let myself out and see if I can find the dumb place on my own.
The man in the chair didn't answer, but his hands were tied on the rifle in his lap, and his eyes were cold and hard as he watched Tillman back out the door. As fast as he could, Tillman rode back to the trail where Heck was waiting.
What'd you find out?
I couldn't see much. It's too dark. But one thing's for sure. There's a passel of men hiding in there. We're gonna need help bringing them in.
They rode over to Pawnee and enlisted the help of Chief Deputy John Hale, who formed a posse. When they got back to the cabin, the only occupant left was the man in the chair.
What's your name, mister?
Tillman spoke to the man after they'd disarmed him of his rifle.
We're done.
Where are the men who were hiding here when I was here before?
The outlaws is already gone. And you would be too, lawman. Bill Doolin hadn't kept his men from shooting you in the back as you left.
What do you mean?
They was all here. Every one of Doolin's gang. Bill Doolin, Red Buck, Charlie Pierce, Tulsa Jack, and Little Bill Rattler. Old Red Buck sure wanted to kill you, Marshal. He was all ready to shoot you in the back. But Bill Doolin stopped him by grabbing his gun hand.
Why'd he do that?
Doolin said Bill Tillman is too good a man to be shot in the back. Red Buck was plenty peeved off of being stopped. Must have a powerful hate for you, Marshal.
Tillman felt a chill up his spine at the close call he'd had. But it wasn't to be his last. Nope, not by a long shot. Bill Tillman turned over in his bunk, the near miss in his dreams leading him to his next encounter with Bill Doolin. A few months after the cabin incident, Bill Doolin and his gang held up the express station at Woodward and made off with over $10,000. Will Dunn, who was being left free but kept on a short leash by the lawmen, informed Tillman that Doolin and some of his men were supposed to meet up at his brother B's place in the next few days. Tillman, Heck Thomas, and a posse rode over to the B. Dunn ranch. Tillman dragged B out to stand in front of the posse.
Dunn, you're going to be arrested and tried as an accomplice if you don't help us capture Doolin and his men when they arrive.
But they'll kill me, deputy.
Better than spending the next 20 years caged up like an animal.
Dunn finally nodded, broken. Tillman staked the posse out around the ranch, hidden and waiting for the outlaws to show up. On the third night, Bitter Creek Newcomb and Charlie Pierce rode up to the corral. When they got just close enough, Heck Thomas stood up, his Winchester in his hand.
Hold on, boys. Put them hands up and give it up now, you hear?
Newcomb and Pierce hesitated only a moment before they jumped from their horses to the ground. Heck and Bill calmly aimed and returned the fire, not even bothering to duck. As the lead slugs whistled around their heads, the two lawmen continued to pull triggers and fight the bucking of their rifles. Newcomb was the first to fall, two slugs hitting him almost simultaneously. He was stopped in midstream as if he'd run into a brick wall, falling dead on the cold, hard ground. Pierce slowed when he saw his partner fall, and that got him killed.
Damn. Now Doolin will never come back to this place.
Yeah, but I'm gonna get him anyway. I heard he's got a hiding place in the Osage Nation. You game to go up there after him with me?
Hell yeah.
They headed for the ranch in the Indian Nations a few days later, finding it just where they'd been told it would be. They rode quietly up to the wooden structure, their guns loose and ready for trouble. As they approached the ranch house, a man walked around the corner, his head down, not seeing the lawman. The gentleman recognized him as Little Bill Radler, a longtime member of the Doolin gang.
Halt, Radler! This is Bill Tillman talking.
When he heard the lawman's voice, Little Bill whirled around and drew. The slug passed within inches of Tillman's head, and he returned fire, striking Radler in the right wrist and shattering the bone as the gun whirled away in the sunlight. They doctored Radler up as well as they could and took him to Guthrie, where he was placed under arrest. He refused to say anything about the whereabouts of Bill Doolin. After a few more unsuccessful attempts to locate Doolin, Tillman was just about to give up when he got word that Doolin's wife was in Winfield. Tillman went to the Winfield post office to see if there'd been any mail delivered to her from her husband. The postman told Tillman that Mr. Doolin was in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. He said the outlaw had gone there to visit the hot springs to ease his rheumatism. Tillman was on a stage the next day, headed for Eureka Springs. The coach he was riding pulled into Eureka Springs on December 5th. Tillman went directly to the Basin Hotel. He checked in and left his rifle and baggage there to go in search of Bill Doolin. As he walked through the lobby, Tillman saw Doolin calmly sitting on a couch reading a newspaper. When Doolin glanced up to see who was walking by, Tillman turned his head and moved away. Then he stopped for a moment, wondering if he should approach the wanted man in this crowded lobby, fearing innocent people would get shot if there were gunplay.
What the hell? I'm chasing him all over creation. Can't let him get out of my sight now.
Tillman pulled his Colt and walked back to stand directly in front of Bill Doolin.
Bill Doolin, you are under arrest.
Doolin assumed an innocent look, glancing around at the people in the lobby who had stopped to see what was going on.
What's the meaning of this?
I'm Deputy Marshal Tillman.
Tillman grabbed his arm, and the two began to wrestle in the lobby. One of the hotel clerks came running up.
What's going on here?
Get his guns from out under his coat while I hold him. I'm a marshal.
The clerk stepped gingerly around the wrestling men, trying to get at the guns under Doolin's coat. He managed to get the coat open.
I'm gonna kill you, kid!
The clerk turned and ran from the room without a backward glance. This put Tillman at a disadvantage. Now that Doolin's coat was open, he was more likely to get his gun sooner or later. Tillman gritted his teeth, released Doolin, and stepped back, whipping his Colt out of his holster before Doolin could draw.
I'll shoot you, Bill, if you go for that gun.
Doolin hesitated, as if figuring out whether he had a chance or not. And then he finally relaxed. His shoulders slumped, and he hung his head as Tillman leaned forward and removed two pistols from shoulder holsters under his coat. The next day, Tillman and Doolin boarded a train headed back to Oklahoma Territory. With the arrest of Doolin accomplished in his dreams, the images faded, and Bill Tillman finally sank into a deep and dreamless sleep. The next morning, after they all ate a breakfast of day-old biscuits and fried chicken, topped off with canned peaches that Sally had brought along on the train, the card game resumed among Lewis, Cal, and Pearly, while Monty joined Smoke and Sally and Bill Tillman for another round of stories. With the details fresh in his mind from his dreams of the night before, Bill was persuaded to tell the tale of his wrestling match with the famous outlaw Bill Doolin. When he'd finished, he glanced at Smoke.
I hear tell you've had some righteous adventures yourself, Smoke. Ever wrestled a bad man to the end?
There were a few times.
Tell him about the time with the Sundance Kid and his gang up in the mountains.
Go
on, dear. We'd all like to hear it to help pass the time away.
The Sundance Kid was this young man who thought he was a bad hombre. During a fight a year before, I'd cut his left ear off to make a point, hoping to save his life by getting him out of the gunfighting business.
I take it the lesson didn't work.
No, in fact, it just made matters worse. Humiliated by the experience, the young man went down to Mexico and recruited a gang of toughs to come back up to Colorado and teach me a lesson. One thing led to another, and before long we were all up in the High Lonesome in a fight to the death.
Smoke was loaded for bear. He had his two Colt 44 pistols, a knife in his scabbard, a tomahawk in his belt against the small of his back, a Henry repeating rifle in one saddle boot, and a heavy greener 10-gauge shotgun on a rawhide thong over his shoulder. He was ready to hunt and to kill anything that got in his way. By late afternoon, he located a party of gunmen looking for him. Unused to traveling in the mountains, they were making so damn much noise that they were easy to find. Smoke stepped out of his saddle, leaving his horse ground-reined for a quick getaway should it be necessary. He slipped down a snowy slope toward a ribbon of trail the gang was following. As the last man in line came abreast of his hiding place, Smoke took a running jump and leapt onto the rider's horse behind him. Before the startled man could make a sound, Smoke slit his throat with his knife. Smoke threw his knife at the next rider in line. Smoke drew his Colt. Two more of Sundance's hired killers were mortally wounded before any had time to clear leather. Smoke whirled the dead man's horse in a tight circle and galloped into the brush, leaning over the saddle to avoid low-hanging branches and limbs. Sundance's gang jerked the reins and tried to turn around to give chase, but the trail was narrow and all they managed to do was get in each other's way. Only minutes after the attack began, Smoke had disappeared and the Gunhawks counted four dead, while not a shot had been fired at the mountain man. Sundance was furious as he rode among his followers.
God damn it! You worthless bastard didn't fire a single round! Hell, I thought I was riding with some tough gun slicks. I might as well have hired school marms for all the help you galoots have been.
I'm gonna kill that son of a bitch! Yeah!
Curly Bill filled his hand with iron and spurred his horse into the brush after Smoke. Three other men pulled guns and started to follow Cartwright.
Hold on there. That's just what Jensen wants us to do. Circle up and get ready in case he comes back. We'll stay here and see what happens. Maybe Cartwright get lucky.
I doubt that, boss. He's going into Jensen's territory now, and I'll bet a double eagle he don't come out.
The gang waited expectantly, every gun trained on the spot where Smoke and Cartwright entered a stand of dense trees. The men cocked pistols and rifles as a horse walked out of the trees and onto the trail. In its saddle was the decapitated body of Curly Bill Cartwright. His head and upper shoulders had been blown off by a double-loaded 10-gauge buckshot. A tree branch had been stuck down the back of his shirt, and his feet were tied together under the animal's belly to keep him upright in his saddle.
Do you think maybe Jensen's sending us a message, boss?
Damn! I want to kill that bastard so bad I can taste it.
What now, jefe? We go into the trees or stay on the trail?
Stay on the trail. If we can locate his camp, we can keep him from getting to his supplies and ammunition. Sooner or later, he'll run low, and then we can take him. Take the point, Grey Wolf, and see if you can find some tracks or a sign showing which way his camp might be.
I don't like this, Bull. I don't like one bit.
Me either, Moses. Me either.
Jeremiah Gray Wolf leaned over his saddle and began to walk his pony up the trail, followed 20 yards back by the rest of the group.
I found some tracks. Let's go.
The engine straightened in his saddle and spurred his mount into a trot, disappearing around a bend in the trail. The others drew weapons and followed him from a distance. Sundance rounded the bend and stopped short when he saw Gray Wolf's pony standing riderless by the side of the trail, grazing on the short grass partially hidden by melting snow. Sundance had not heard a sound, not even a call for help. When the rest of his men rode up to him, Sundance slowly urged his horse forward, scanning trees and brush on either side for a sign of Gray Wolf.
Madre de Dios.
Sundance turned to see Pedro Muerte crossing himself and staring up at a nearby tree. He followed Pedro Muerte's gaze and found Jeremiah Gray Wolf hanging from a limb, a rope around his neck, his legs still kicking and quivering in death throes. The engine's bowels had let loose and the stench was overpowering. Sundance held his bandana across his nose and rode over to examine the area under the body. Horse tracks showed that Smoke had probably roped the man while hiding in a tree, then dropped to his horse, pulling Gray Wolf out of his saddle by a rope he'd looped over the branch.
He never knew what hit him.
Shut up! Come on. It can't be more than a few hundred feet away. Let's go!
The group cocked their weapons and started to follow Sundance up a slope past the tree with the body hanging from it. It was a steep grade covered with loose gravel and small stones. They made it about halfway up the incline. They looked up to see Smoke standing next to a large pile of boulders, grinning and holding something in one hand and a smoking cigar in the other.
Howdy, gents!
Smoke put his cigar against the object in his other hand. He dropped the bundle among the rocks and ducked out of sight.
Done, mate!
The men panicked and reined their horses to turn in different directions, running into each other and knocking men and animals to the ground.
Oh, shit.
Slowly at first, then with gathering speed, huge rocks rolled and tumbled, racing down the slope, bounding as they descended toward the track riders milling about on the trail. A huge dust cloud enveloped the area as rocks crushed bones and flattened bodies and ended lives. When the dust had settled, the only men left alive were Sundance, Lightning Jack, Bull, and Pedro Muerte. The slide had killed four Texas gunfighters and Moses Washburn, who could only be identified by his hand showing from beneath a huge boulder. In the sudden quiet of dusk, the remaining men could hear the sounds of Jensen's horse in the distance, galloping up the mountain.
Moses, I'm gonna kill him for you.
Okay, boys. He's headed straight up the mountain. There ain't much cover up there, and there ain't nowhere to run once he gets up to the top. Let's go get him!
The moon had risen, and the cloudless sky was as bright as day. Smoke was hidden in his natural fortress, leaning over the edge, peering below through his binoculars, waiting for Sundance and his men. It was time to end it, and he was ready. There was movement below, and Smoke could see Bull and Pedro Muerte crawling on hands and knees off to his right. They were going to try to inch up the slope, using small logs and rocks on that side for cover. Smoke grinned, remembering tricks Cal had devised for just that eventuality. Smoke waited until they were halfway up the incline.
Hey, Bull!
The big man squinted in semi-darkness, trying to see where Jensen's voice was coming from, hoping to get off a lucky shot.
Yeah, what do you want, Jensen? You want to know how I'm going to kill you?
No. I was just wondering if you noticed all those gourds and pumpkins down there.
Bull and Pedro Muerte glanced around them and saw for the first time a number of small squash and pumpkins resting on the ground. Bull looked up the slope.
Yeah? What about it? You hungry?
Did you ever wonder, you ignorant bastard, how gourds could grow on bare rock?
Bull's eyes widened in horror, and he opened his mouth to scream as he realized the trap they had fallen into. Smoke fired into the pumpkin directly in front of him. The object exploded, blasting hundreds of small stones hurtling outward. Bull's and Pedro Muerte's bodies were riddled, shredded, blown to pieces. They died instantly. Below, Sundance wiped sweat off his forehead and turned to Lightning Jack.
Maybe we ought to head down the mountain and come back later with more men.
You coward. You got over 30 men killed looking for your vengeance. You ain't backing out now.
Sundance dropped his hand to his Colt.
Hold it right there, gents.
Lightning Jack and Sundance turned to see a small, wiry man in buckskins pointing a shotgun at their heads.
Easy irons out of those holsters and grab some sky.
They dropped their pistols to the ground.
Hey, Smoke, got me a couple polecats in my sight. What do you want me to do with them?
Bring them up here.
As the outlaws struggled uphill, the mountain man, more than twice their age, walked nimbly up the slope with never a misstep. Nor was he even breathing hard when they reached the top. Smoke just stood there, hands on his hips, shaking his head at Puma.
It's easier to tree a grizzly than to keep you ornery old-timers out of a good fight.
Yeah, I'd rather bed down with a skunk than miss a good fracas. Want me to dust him now or just take him out over an anthill?
You wouldn't do that! What, you son of a bitch?
Well, I'm feeling real generous tonight. How about you boys picking your own way to die? Guns, knives, fists, or boots? Makes no difference to me.
Are you man enough to take me on hand to hand? Winner goes free.
Smoke removed belt and holsters, took a pair of padded black gloves out of his pants and began to pull them on.
Puma, if this loudmouth beats me, take his left ear as a souvenir and let him go.
How about I take his top knot instead?
Wait a minute.
Smoke stepped into the middle of a level area at the top of the plateau.
Let's dance.
Any rules?
Yeah. The man left alive at the end is the winner.
Just the way I like it. Say goodbye to your friend, Mountain Man.
Lightning Jack suddenly rushed at Smoke, swinging roundhouse blows with both arms. Smoke unloaded two short, sharp left jabs. Jack shook his head, a dazed look on his face. Smoke stood spread-eagled, his fist in front of him, waiting patiently. Jack pulled a knife from his boot. Smoke took the blade in the outer part of his left shoulder, then bent to his right, and he swung with all his might. His fist hit Jack in the throat, crushing his larynx. The knife slipped from Jack's numb fingers, and he fell to his knees, grabbing his neck with both hands. Smoke staggered in pain, then straightened, a steely glint in his eyes as blood seeped from the wound to stain his shirt. Puma started toward him, but Smoke waved him away.
Not yet, Puma. We got one more snake to stomp before we're through.
But I'm not much good with my fists. I ain't no prize fighter.
You fancy yourself a gunfighter?
Yeah, and I'm a hell of a lot better than I was last time you bushwhacked me, Jensen. I've been practicing for years.
Smoke, his left arm hanging limp at his side, bent down and picked up his belt and holsters.
Buckle this on for me, would you, Puma?
Puma placed the guns around Smoke's waist and snapped the buckle shut, then tied the right-hand holster down low on his thigh. Smoke slipped the hammer thongs off both guns using his right hand, stepping over to the center of the plateau.
Give the lowlife his pistol, Puma. Then watch your back. Sundance is famous for shooting people from the north when they're facing south.
You're gonna die for that, Jensen.
The two men squared off, 30 yards apart, hands hanging loose, fingers flexing in anticipation.
You called this place, Sundance. Now it's time for you to pay the band. Feel your damn hand.
Smoke's bullet took Sundance in the right wrist, snapping it, flinging his Colt into the dirt.
Okay, you bastard, you win!
No, I don't think so. You've got another gun and another hand. Use them.
My left hand against your right? That ain't fair!
Smoke shook his head, twirled his right-hand Colt once, and then he settled it in his holster.
I'll cross-draw my left gun, if that's more to your liking.
Sundance's lips curled in a tight smile. The cross draw was not a speed draw. No one could beat him with a cross draw, even left-handed.
Okay. It's your call, Jensen.
Sundance stood up and threw his shoulders back and went for his iron. Smoke's right hand flashed across his belly. This time, Smoke Slug took the outlaw on his left shoulder, shattering it while spinning him around to land face down on the ground.
Bring me a rope from that bag over yonder.
Smoke took the rope from Puma, formed a large loop, and passed it over Sundance's arms to tie it around his chest. He dragged the gunman across the plateau to the edge of the cliff on the east side of the clearing.
Help me lower him down onto that ledge down there, Puma.
What are you doing? No, please!
The two mountain men lowered the outlaw 20 feet down the side of that sheer cliff and led him down gently onto a 3-foot ledge that stuck out over a drop of 200 feet.
I'm gonna do something for you that you never did for your victim, Sundance. I'm gonna give you a choice about the way you wanna die. You can lay there on that ledge and slowly starve to death. Or you can jump and fall 200 feet so you'll die quickly. It's all up to you.
Wait, you can't do this to me. It ain't right.
Smoke and Puma slowly walked away then. Neither one much cared how Sundance chose to die, just so long as he died. And that was a certainty. Tillman shook his head.
Smoke, that makes my little freight car seem like a Sunday school out.
Bill, things were a lot different back then, and especially up in the High Lonesome. The only rules were there were no rules.
When the train pulled into the station at Houston, Smoke's group exited and got their baggage from the baggage car.
What now? Do we head for Galveston right away?
Smoke glanced at Sally, who was stretching and trying to get the kinks out caused by 2 days on a rough-riding railroad car.
It's all the same to you, Marcia. I think we could all do with some good cooking and a night in a fine hotel.
Yes, please. One with a hot bath and a soft feather mattress.
I guess another day won't make much difference. I hear it's almost 50 miles to Galveston, and tell you the truth, I don't hanker to spend another couple of days in a stagecoach right about now.
They went to the biggest hotel they could find, one called the Capitol Hotel. The proprietor told them that the beautiful building had once been the Capitol Building of Texas, until the government was moved to Austin.
All I want to know is, do you have a bath with hot water?
The desk clerk looked offended.
But of course, madam. The Capitol has all the modern conveniences, as well as a first-rate dining room.
Pearly's ears picked up at the mention of a dining room.
Forget about the bath, just show me where the grub is.
Pearly, if you plan to eat with us, you will take a bath first. After all, cleanliness is next to godliness.
Yeah, but starvation isn't.
The next morning, after all were well-rested and well-fed, Smoke hired a special stage just for them for the 2-day journey to Galveston. As they bounced and rumbled over the trail from Houston toward Galveston, Sally noticed the sparkling gold badge Tillman had pinned on his shirt under his vest.
That's a very interesting badge you have there, Mr. Tillman. It looks almost as if it's made of gold.
Man, I gotta get me a job with the U.S. Marshals Service if they're giving out badges made of gold now.
No, Monty. Didn't come with a job. Back when I was appointed, a group of my friends had a blacksmith hammer this one out of 2 $20 pieces. It's a bit gaudy for my taste, but what could I do? Didn't want to insult my friends.
They must have really appreciated what you were doing for them.
Let me tell you something about law enforcement, Cal. The average citizen appreciates what you're doing for him, only so long as it doesn't inconvenience him in any way. But as soon as you tell him he can't walk his horse on a boardwalk or carry a gun inside town limits, suddenly you're not so popular anymore.
Whoa!
Pearly leaned his head out the window, his hand holding his hat to keep it from blowing off. He ducked back inside, his hand going for the butt of his pistol.
Uh-oh. Looks like trouble up ahead.
What is it?
Looks like about 10 or 15 men on horseback in the middle of the road ahead. Just sitting there with rifle butts resting on their thighs.
Sally pulled her purse around, opened it, and withdrew her short-barreled .32 Smith & Wesson. She arranged her frock coat to cover it as she stuck it in the waistband of her dress. Everyone piled out, looking ahead at the group of men sitting on their horses in front of the team pulling the stage. The driver already had his hands above his head.
We ain't carrying no gold.
The leader of the group was a broad-shouldered Mexican, squat, bordering on fat, with crossed bandoliers of shotgun shells on his chest and a sawed-off greener in his hands.
Buenos dias, señores y señoritas. I am El Gato. That means mountain cat.
We understand, Mex. What do you want?
Why, nothing much, señor. My compadres and me are poor vaqueros who want nothing more than a few pesos to feed our hungry children.
As he spoke, Monty, Lewis, Smoke, Cal, and Pearlie slowly edged sideways to be away from Sally so when the shooting started, as they all knew it was gonna, she wouldn't be in the direct line of fire.
You'll get nothing from us.
Oh, senor, that is most unfriendly.
El Gato opened his mouth in a wide grin, exposing blackened stubs of teeth.
Where are you from, mister?
Just across the border, senor. A place called Piedras Negras. Why do you ask?
I just wondered if they didn't have dentists where you come from.
As I said, the senor is not being friendly.
You got 5 seconds to get out of the way and let this stage proceed. I'm a U.S. Marshal, and I'm ordering you out of the way.
You do not order El Gato! Can you not see I have 15 men to your 6?
I know the odds aren't fair, but we just don't have time for you to go and get more men.
El Gato's eyes widened in amazement, and he started to lower the barrel of his shotgun. Smoke's group all drew at one time. Smoke and Tillman both aimed for El Gato, figuring without their leader, the other bandidos wouldn't be as brave. El Gato's men managed to get off 2 wild shots before Smoke and his friends opened fire. Sally, only a second slower than the men, had her .32 in her hand and knocked 2 of the bandits out of their saddles before they could clear leather. Monty got 3 men, Cal 2, and Pearlie 3 as well, within seconds of beginning the dance. As the giant cloud of gun smoke and cordite slowly drifted away on the Texas breeze coming in from the Gulf of Mexico, bodies could be seen lying sprawled all over the landscape. Some still moving in pain or trying to crawl away on hands and knees, dripping blood to mix with the dirt and form a scarlet mud that reeked of death.
Should we finish them off, Marshal?
No. Just take their weapons and scatter their horses. The coyotes and wolves don't finish them, the buzzards will.
Tillman looked at the stagecoach driver, who was looking at the contents of his stomach over by the coach.
What's the matter? You hit?
Hell no! When all the shooting started, I plumb saw my jaw to back it. Oh, damn near killed me.
Tillman walked over to Smoke, who was making sure Sally was all right.
Yes, dear, but I ripped my dress pulling out my Smith & Wesson, and I didn't pack my sewing kit.
Smoke shook his head and turned to watch Cal and Pearlie and Monty move among the wounded men, picking up their guns and shooing their horses away. Lewis walked up to Smoke and Tillman and grimaced.
Damn.
What is it, Lewis?
Now there are 2 men who are almost as fast in the draw as I am.
Do you think we should just let him go on in his delusion?
Sure, why not? I've always said it's not who's the fastest on the draw that counts. It's who puts his lead where it needs to go that counts most in a gunfight.
By the way, Marshal, you mind telling me why you shot El Gato in the stomach instead of the chest or head?
We have a saying in the Marshal Service, Smoke. 2 in the belly and 1 in the head sure makes a man dead.
I was just starting on the belly when you beat me to the draw and put 1 in his head.
I made a deal with myself the day I went into being a lawman. If I ever have to shoot, I'm going to shoot till the job gets done. It's the only way to survive.
The stagecoach pulled up at a large dock, bustling with activity. Across the bay, dim outlines of Galveston Island could be seen through sea mist hanging low over the warm salt water. There were wagons lined up, waiting for the ferry, carrying all manner of agricultural goods. But most prevalent were the many bales of cotton stacked 1 or 2 to a wagon.
My goodness! This place looks busier than Dallas.
It is, ma'am. Up north, all they talk about is cattle, but down here, except for the King Ranch, of course,
Cotton is king.
After waiting in line for some time, the stage was finally allowed on the ferry, and they made the short trip across the bay without incident. Though Pearly refused to get out of the coach and walk around the ferry as the others did.
If God had wanted a man near this much water, he'd have made us with webbed feet like ducks.
Finally, they made their way to downtown Galveston, which was just a few blocks from the beachfront. And Sally was amazed to see large, fine homes comparable to any she'd seen on her travels to visit her family in New York City. The group disembarked at the stage depot, where there was another group of people waiting to make the trip back to Houston, it being a common destination for the well-to-do to travel to for both business and pleasure. Smoke paid off the driver, and they proceeded to the Galvez Hotel, which was on a bluff overlooking the breaking waves of the Gulf of Mexico and the pure white beaches of the island.
Let's get some grub and make some plans on how to find Gomez. Got it.
Sounds good to me.
The mention of food always sounds good to you, Pearly.
Down on the waterfront, Three Fingers Gomez and Curly Bob Gatling, just awaking from a night of revelry in the red light district of Galveston, gathered for breakfast at a small diner frequented by seamen. The Albatross was a small, single-roomed shack made of what looked like driftwood and old lumber washed up on shore during storms, and was just up the beach above the high water line of seaweed set back in the sand dunes. Its main attraction was not the cuisine, which was plain but adequate. Instead, it was the wide selection of liquors and beers that were served at all hours, breakfast being no exception. As the two men leaned over their food in the dimly lit diner, Three Fingers Gomez looked up.
When do they say that ship will be sailing?
Tomorrow.
Damn.
Gomez glanced out the window at the many ships moored in Galveston Harbor.
All them boats out there. I think they'd have some going away for then.
Yeah, they do, but most of them are freighters. They don't carry but a couple passengers each. I got us in line to get the first places available. Why are you so jumpy? Why not just sit back and enjoy the nightlife here? Hell, they got more good-looking women here than I ever seen before. We finally got some spending money in our pockets from selling those beeves.
It's just that I got these here itch on the back of my neck. Somebody's on our back trail. I can't enjoy myself for looking over my shoulder to see who might be there.
Well, one thing I've learned after all my years riding the Owl Hoot Trail, partner, is that you can't think about what may be behind you. If you do, you soon go crazy in the head.
How do you stop?
You gotta live one day at a time. You got to figure you're gonna take a dirt nap soon enough, so worrying about it don't do no good. When it happens, it happens.
Gomez finished his eggs and coffee and pushed the plate away from him on the table.
That's easy for you to say, Curly Bob. But you didn't put a bullet in that kid. You don't have that Jensen fella on your trail.
What do you mean by that? We're partners, ain't we? If they're after you, that means they're after me too. When it comes right down to it, if Jensen's still alive, which I doubt, he ain't gonna just come up to us and say, which one of you shot the kid? Nope. He's gonna just show up and start blazing away with those big colts of his. So I got as much to lose as you, Three Fingers.
I know, Curly Bob. You're a good friend. And I know I can count on you if push comes to shove.
That's right. Now, we got 24 hours till we sail for the East Coast. So let's see how many women we can bag and how much whiskey we can drink between now and then.
After settling in at the Galvez and cleaning up from their dusty journey from Houston, the group met at the Galvez restaurant, where they dined on red snapper, speckled trout, fresh blue crabs, and oysters on the half shell, along with fried potatoes, coleslaw, and cornbread. Pearly eyed the oysters skeptically.
Ugh, I don't know about eating those things.
Pearly picked up an oyster shell and held it under his nose.
Don't smell it, Pearly. Eat it.
Sally took a shell in her hand, poured some red sauce on it, and tipped it up, letting it slide down her throat in one gulp. Pearly watched her through narrowed eyes.
What's it taste like?
Delicious. I haven't had food this good since New York.
Pearly was thinking, but had the manners not to say. that he wasn't sure he wanted to eat food that looked like something he'd hocked up from the back of his throat.
They say that oysters are good for your nature.
Nature? There ain't nothing wrong with my nature. What's nature?
It's something somebody your age don't have to worry none about, Cal.
How about you, Monty? Are you going to partake of one of the sea's best delicacies?
No, Lewis. My nature don't need no stirring up. Not with Mary 1,000 miles away. Though I might see if I can take something back to Big Rock with me.
As smoke wolfed down a quick half dozen of the oysters, Sally glanced at him and leaned over to whisper in his ear.
Go easy on those, big fella. You don't need any help with your nature, either. It's fine just as it is.
After they finished the meal, Sally went to browse the shops along the waterfront next to the hotel, and the men went to the shipping offices at the Port Authority. While Tillman and Smoke went in to talk to the clerk, Monty and Lewis and Cal and Pearlie strolled along the beach, picking up shells and enjoying the balmy day. A half hour later, Smoke and Tillman emerged, smiles on their faces.
What did you find out?
Yeah, we asked around out here, and word is there's more than 100 bars and saloons and houses of ill repute along the wharf. Ain't no way we're gonna find two men among all those, not unless we get awful lucky.
We got lucky. The clerk in there went through the records for us and found Juan Gomez and Robert Gatlin, scheduled to sail out on the Sea Sprite tomorrow morning to Georgia.
I can't believe they're still here. They had a 2 or 3 day start on us.
There again, we got lucky. The clerk told us the ships were backed up and running late due to some storms in the Gulf. There hasn't been a ship out of here for the past 4 days, or they'd probably be long gone.
So what's the plan?
I'm going to relax and spend the day with Sally, shopping and seeing the sights. It isn't often we get to make a trip like this together. Then tomorrow, at dawn, Marshal Tillman and I are going to get on the ship early and be waiting for the two killers when they board.
What about us?
You'll be our backup. You'll cover the roads to the ferry and the area around the ship's loading docks, just in case they decide to leave Galveston instead of boarding the ship, or in case they get by us.
Well, while you play dutiful husband, Smoke, I'm going to check out the various gaming establishments along the shore here and see if Texicans can play poker any better than the men in Colorado.
You mind if Cal and I tag along, Lewis? I'm going to try out what you taught us on the train, see if I can win some money.
Not at all, Pearlie. How about you, Monty?
Sure, why not? Beats hanging around the hotel missing my wife.
The next morning, Smoke and Tillman, followed by Lewis, Monty, Cal, and Pearlie, walked through a fog so thick you could cut it with a knife. The sun wasn't quite up, but the eastern clouds were beginning to turn a brilliant orange and red and yellow on the horizon. When they got to the dock where the Sea Sprite was moored, Tillman stationed the other men around the area as a precaution, and he and Smoke walked up the gangplank. A burly sailor, his massive arms covered with tattoos, started to stop him, but backed off when Tillman pulled his vest back and showed him his gold badge. They went to the quartermaster and asked him which cabin was assigned to Gomez and Gatlin.
Number 3.
The men led him down a long, dark, dank corridor to the room, which he opened for him. The cabin was incredibly small, and both Tillman and Smoke had to duck their heads, not being able to stand erect in the tiny enclosure.
Can't wait for him here. No room to maneuver in case they resist.
You're right. Let's get settled up on deck. We can brace them there when they come aboard.
They searched the upper deck until they found the right place to hide, just behind the opening to the below decks area. It was a small, raised wooden structure that would keep them concealed until the two men were well on board. Then they could step out and arrest them. Smoke and Tillman settled down, sitting on coils of rope as thick as Smoke's arm. And they smoked and talked of Western things until it was almost 8 o'clock. Tillman peeked over the wooden structure and could see several people making their way toward the ship.
Time to get ready.
Strike up the band.
Start the dance.
Three Fingers Gomez and Curly Bob Gatling strolled up the gangplank. Gomez was smiling.
You see, partner, I told you we didn't have nothing to worry about. Jensen's dead, and we're on our way to Georgia.
Smoke and Bill Tillman stepped out from behind the entranceway to the cabins, their hands hanging next to their pistol butts.
The reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated.
God damn!
Gatling stopped dead in his tracks and dropped the duffel bag he had slung over his shoulder. He glanced at Gomez, who was shaking his head.
I knew it. I told you I found someone on our trail.
Juan Gomez and Robert Gatling. I'm a U.S. Deputy Marshal, and I arrest you for the murder of Jim Slade, known as the Durango Kid.
Gatling held out his hand.
I didn't have nothing to do with the kid's murder.
But you did conspire to have Smoke Jensen murdered by paying some vaqueros to kill him, didn't you? I think you boys have a date with George Maladon.
Who is this Maldon fella? I don't know no Maldon.
He's known as the Prince of Hangmen. He is the chief executioner for Judge Isaac Parker, the man who's gonna judge you boys.
Gomez began backing away, his hands near his pistol.
I ain't gonna get my neck stretched for killing a snake like the Durango Kid. It ain't fair.
It ain't fair to be shot in the back either. But the kid didn't have any choice in the matter. And neither do you, Gomez.
Yes, I do!
Gomez went for his gun. Gatling did the same, crouching and slapping at his holster. Smoke and Tillman drew in the same instant. Gomez flung his arms backward, his pistol still in its holster, as the molten lead from Smoke's Colt punched a hole in his chest and exploded his heart. He whirled around and fell face down on the deck of the ship, but he felt no pain because he was dead before he hit the deck. Tillman's slug took Gatling in the gut, his gun also still in its holster. He doubled over. Tillman's next shot entered the top of Gatling's head. Smoke put his Colt back in its holster. Tillman just let his hand drop to his side, shaking his head at the waste of human life he'd seen. Tillman turned his head and stared at Smoke.
I'd always heard you were fast enough to snatch a quarter off a snake's head and leave change before he could strike. Guess I heard right.
I think you beat me by a split second, Marshal.
No way, Smoke. It was a dead heat.
I mean never to draw against you, Bill.
Don't worry, Mountain Man, I will.
Smoke and everyone said their goodbyes to Marshal Bill Tillman at the ferry on the mainland side of the Bay of Galveston. He was heading back north to Arkansas to file his report on the murder of the Durango Kid, while Smoke and his friends were heading south to Corpus Christi and the King Ranch. Smoke stuck out his hand.
Marshal, it's been a pleasure knowing you.
Tillman took his hand and shook it.
Same here, Smoke. I'll be sure and clear your name with Judge Parker and let him know it was all a mistake.
So, I don't need to stop by there on my way back to Colorado?
No, I don't think so. Besides, from what I hear, the judge would just as soon not have to face Mrs. Jensen again. It seems she made quite an impression on him after their last meeting.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah. He said something about how he'd rather face a mad dog than another woman like her taking up for her man in his court.
Smoke smiled at Sally.
She does have a rather forceful way about her when her dander's up.
I resent that. I just told him the truth that Smoke Jensen would never shoot anyone in the back.
Oh, it's not what you said, Miss Sally. It's how you said it. You see, the judge, he kind of feels like he's the king of his courtroom. And he's not used to someone getting in his face like you did. It upsets his equilibrium somehow.
Well, the only king in my world is Smoke. And the judge will just have to accept that fact.
Smoke and his group of friends spent an enjoyable week at the King Ranch near Corpus Christi. Sally was much impressed by the modern way Richard King and his foreman used new scientific methods to improve the breed of cattle known as Santa Gertrudes. She hounded the poor foreman for several days, inquiring about bloodlines and breeding methods and feed and the amount of meat they could expect from their shorthorn crosses with the Gertrudes bulls. Until by the time they'd taken the bulls to the train yards for shipment to Colorado, he was glad to see her go. While Sally was inquiring into the breeding and care of the new breeds, Richard King took Smoke, Cal, Pearly, Monty, and Lewis hunting on his thousands of acres of prime land. Smoke, after killing a Texas mule deer, allowed as how he'd never seen a deer that big. Pearly and Cal were more impressed by the number of quail and doves they killed, especially Pearly, who'd said he'd never tasted anything so good as quail barbecued over a mesquite fire.
So, you like them better than oysters?
Lewis was gnawing meat off of one of the small birds next to the campfire. King glanced at Pearly.
You didn't care for our oysters?
Not enough so as you can tell.
That's the first thing I ever saw old Pearly Wouldn't eat.
I done told you, ain't nothing wrong with my nature.
Well, out here on the ranch, we have another kind of oyster you might like better.
If you're talking about mountain oysters, we got those up in Colorado, too. And they're not too high on my list of things I like to eat either.
But, Pearly, you always said you liked the stew that Puma Buck made for us when we stayed up in the High Lonesome with him that winter.
Pearly turned his head to stare at Smoke.
You don't mean...
Yep. One of the prime ingredients was deer testicles, or mountain oysters, as you call it. Where do you think they got the name?
Pearly made a face and got up from the campfire.
Excuse me, gentlemen. I think I'll go wash out my mouth.
Pass me another one of them quail quick before Pearly comes back and eats them all up.
Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man number 26, Justice of the Mountain Man, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2000, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by James Lewis, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tim Getman, Drew Copus, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowan, Michael John Casey, David Coyne, Thomas Keegan, Joe Brack, Johann Detweiler, Kimberly Gilbert, Nanette Savard, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Christopher Sheeran, Michael Glenn, Andy Clements, and Eric Messner. Additional Boot Hill Boys by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and Smoke Jensen theme music by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Justice of the Mountain Man, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com and be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man, The Last Mountain Man, Blood Bond, The Last Gunfighter, Eagles and Sidewinder series, as well as Elmer Kelton's Texas Rangers series. All available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. We appreciate it.
Open my vision. Open my vision. Show me what I seek.
In a forgotten time, when ice shrouded the earth, a powerful dreamer heard a desperate cry and went forth on a spirit journey. Two boys, one born in light, a dream in his eyes. The other born in blood, a raven feather clutched in his fist. Between the dreamer and the child of light, a bond was formed.
Yes, you dream, child. And now that I know you, I'll be waiting.
Sun father's losing his strength. Cloud mother wraps herself around blue sky man and sucks up his warmth. This year, Mammoth will die. The people will wither.
Where are you, Father Son?
17 long darks later, young Runzin Light braved the cold and the spirits of the long dark to find food for his people. It was then that he met Wolf.
My brother, let me kill you. The people starve. We are worthy of you.
Renewed by the heart flood of Wolf, Runzin Light fell into an exhausted sleep, and Wolf gave him a dream.
There, you see? There to the south, through the crack in the ice. Walk with me.
This is the land of the people. Bless you for showing me this way. I will bring the people here.
Runzin Light brings meat, and he brings a dream.
Wolf gave the meat to me to take us south. He came in a dream and showed me the way.
As you go south to death, hear me, Father Son. I, Crow Caller, have your dream.
I follow Wolf. Anyone who eats the meat of Wolf follows my dream.
What? Words of valor from my brother?
You and me, brother, we're the future. Don't do what you're planning, or in the end, one of us will have to destroy the other.
You'd best hope it never comes to that, brother.
And so the people split in two between the dreamers. Dancing Fox, beloved of Runzin Light, was obliged to go north with her husband, Crow Caller.
Dancing Fox, here you are.
Raven Hunter, what do you want?
I want you for my woman, Dancing Fox.
Crow Caller, he'll...
Crow Caller is a foolish old man. I can handle him. You won't be mine.
Never.
And I'll have to do it the hard way.
No!
Runzin Light led his people south, where he found Heron, the dreamer he was destined to find from the hour of his birth.
Look me in the eyes, boy. Tell me what Wolf told you.
There's a hole in the big ice. He said if we went that way, the people would be saved.
You have to find the hole inside you before you'll find the one in the ice.
Meanwhile, Raven Hunter followed his own dark path.
Ready? Let's go.
Follow me! Follow and we'll drive these others from our land!
Graphic Audio presents a majestic new series, North America's Forgotten Past, by W. Michael Gear and Kathleen O'Neill Gear. Book 1. People of the Wolf. Part 1. In Graphic Audio.
Yeah, this son of a bitch is guilty. You know it, and I know it, and I say, let's hang the bastard.
Yeah! All right, it's now time to poll the jury. Jury, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty! Guilty!
Well, yeah, so say you won, so say you all.
Yeah, that's what we all say.
Mr. Matt Jensen, you have been found guilty of murder and are sentenced to hang.
On his way to Yuma to hang for a crime he didn't commit, Matt Jensen will be involved in the worst train wreck in Arizona history.
How's it coming?
We pulled out a couple of the spikes, but they're damn hard to remove.
They're supposed to be hard to get out. All you have to do is pull up enough of them to be able to push the rail out a few inches.
You sure that'll stop the train?
You ever seen a train run on dirt?
Now Matt will stop at nothing to bring the men responsible for killing so many innocent people to the only justice he knows. The justice of the gun.
It's you! You son of a bitch! I'm gonna gut you like a hog!
Like an avenging angel, Matt Jensen will deliver the villains unto the hands of the devil in Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man Number 3, Purgatory.
I'll see you in hell!
Not likely. I've done my time in purgatory.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.